Okay, so now what we need to do is to find some sufficient conditions for the existence of Riemann-Stieltjes integrals. Here's a theorem: let f be continuous on AB and assume that alpha is monotonically increasing, then the integral from A to B of f d alpha exists. So that's a succinct statement about when Riemann-Stieltjes integrals exist, and it should remind you of the theorem we proved about Riemann integrals, that any continuous function is Riemann integrable. So this is a direct generalization of that result. Proof: we may assume that alpha is non-constant, otherwise there's nothing to prove because all the delta alphas will be zero. Pick epsilon bigger than zero by the uniform continuity of f on this compact interval. We may choose a delta bigger than zero so that if s minus t, an absolute value, is less than delta, then absolute fs minus ft is less than epsilon divided by the quantity alpha b minus alpha a. Let script p, capital script p, be any partition of ab that has mesh smaller than delta. Then the absolute value of the upper sum fp alpha minus the lower sum fp alpha equals absolute value summation j capital M j delta alpha j minus summation j lowercase m j alpha delta alpha j. And that equals the sum over j of the absolute value of the quantity capital M j minus lowercase m j times delta alpha j. And this is less than, by our choice of delta, epsilon over alpha b minus alpha a times delta alpha j, the summation of that quantity, and this equals summation epsilon over alpha b minus alpha a times summation delta alpha j. But of course, the summation delta alpha j just adds up to alpha b minus alpha a, so that cancels the denominator. We end up with the epsilon. So of course, we use the monotonicity of alpha to observe that that last sum collapses to alpha b minus alpha a. By Riemann's lemma, now the proof is complete. So you can see that it's very simple to use Riemann's lemma. You may find it instructive to compare the proofs of this section with the rather difficult proofs in the second lecture on integration. What we are learning is that a good definition and accompanying lemmas can, in the end, make everything much clearer and simpler. Now we establish a companion result to the first one. Theorem: if alpha is an increasing and continuous function on the interval AB, and if f is monotonic on AB, then the integral of f d alpha exists. So now we're allowing f to be more general, but we have to put more conditions on alpha. Proof: we may assume that alpha b is greater than alpha a, and that f is monotone increasing. Let L be alpha b minus alpha a, capital L, and let capital M be f b minus f and a. Pick epsilon bigger than zero. By the Archimedean property, choose a positive integer k so large that L dot M over k is less than epsilon. Let P naught be A, and choose P1 to be the first point to the right of P naught so that alpha P1 minus alpha P naught equals L over k. This is possible by the intermediate value theorem since alpha is continuous and increasing. Continuing, choose PJ to the first point to the right of PJ minus 1 so that alpha PJ minus alpha PJ minus 1 equals L over k. So we do this over and over again. The process will terminate after k steps, and we will have pk equals b. Then capital script p equals p naught p1 through pk is a partition of ab. Next, observe that for each j, the value capital mj of sup f on ij is equal to fpj since f is increasing. So the sup will always take place at the right-hand point. Similarly, the value little mj inf f on ij is f of pj minus 1. The infimum will take place at the left-hand point endpoint. We find, therefore, that the upper Riemann-Stieltjes sum of fp alpha minus the lower Riemann-Stieltjes sum of fp alpha is summation j equals 1 to k capital mj delta alpha j minus summation j equals 1 to k lowercase mj delta alpha j, and this is equal to the sum from j equal 1 to k quantity capital MJ minus lowercase MJ times L over K, and this is equal to L over K times the summation J equals 1 to K, F of XJ minus F of XJ minus 1, and of course that sum collapses, and you end up with L times M over K, and by choice of K, that's less than epsilon. Therefore, the inequality in Riemann's lemma is satisfied, and the integral exists. One of the useful features of Riemann-Stieltjes integration is that it puts integration by parts into a very natural setting. We start with a lemma, let f be a continuous on an interval ab and let g be monotone increasing and continuous on the interval. If g, capital G is an antiderivative for little g, then the integral from a to b of fx gx dx equals the integral from a to b of f times d capital G. So using the formalism of calculus, you see d of capital G is the derivative of capital G, which is little gx times dx. When you took calculus, you use tricks like that all the time. Let's apply the mean. You prove this by applying the mean value theorem to the Riemann-Stieltjes sums for the integral on the right, and I'll let you think about that. And now here's a formulation of integration by parts that should look familiar. Suppose that little f and little g are continuous increasing functions on the interval AB. Let capital F be an antiderivative for little f. Let capital G be an antiderivative for little g on the interval AB. Then we have the integral from a to b of f d capital F d capital G equals the quantity capital F at b capital G at b minus capital F at a times capital G at a minus the integral from a to b of capital G d capital F. So that's integration by parts, just like the way you've seen it before. And the proof is straightforward. Notice that by the preceding lemma, both integrals exist. Set capital Px equal capital Fx times capital Gx, then P has a continuous derivative on the interval AB. So the fundamental theorem of calculus applies, and we have that capital P at B minus capital P at A is the integral from A to B of P prime x dx, which is equal to the antiderivative of P prime evaluated at B minus the antiderivative of P prime evaluated at A, which is capital F at B, capital G at B minus capital F at A, capital G at A. Now, writing out P prime explicitly using Leibniz's rule for the derivative of a product, we find that the integral from A to B of capital Fx lowercase gx dx equals capital F at B, capital G at B minus capital F at A, capital G at A minus the integral from A to B of capital Gx lowercase fx dx, but the lemma now allows us to rewrite this equation as the integral from a to b of capital F d capital G equals capital Fb capital Gb minus capital Fa capital Ga minus the integral from a to b of capital Gx df. And that's integration by parts. It is also possible to prove the integration by parts formula by applying summation by parts to the Riemann-Stieltjes sums for the integral from a to b capital F d capital G. And the exercises will explore that technique. We have already observed that the Riemann-Stieltjes integral from a to b of f d alpha is linear in f. That is to say, the integral from a to b of f plus g d alpha is the integral from a to b of f d alpha, plus the integral from a to b of g d alpha, and also the integral from a to b of c times f d alpha is c times the integral from a to b of f d alpha when both f and g are Riemann-Stieltjes integral with respect to alpha and for any constant c. We also would expect from the very way that the integral is constructed that it would be linear in the alpha entry. But we have not even defined the Riemann-Stieltjes integral for non-increasing alpha. And what if a function alpha that is the difference of two increasing functions? Such a function need not be monotone. Is it possible to identify which functions alpha can be decomposed to sums or differences of monotonic functions? It turns out that there is a satisfactory answer to these questions, and we'd like to discuss this matter with you a little bit. Definition: if alpha is monotonically decreasing on the interval AB and f is a function on AB, then we define the integral from AB of fd alpha to be minus the integral of fd minus alpha when the right-hand side exists. Of course, the point here is that minus alpha will be monotonically increasing because alpha itself is monotonically decreasing. And so the earlier theory applies to minus alpha. Next, we have definition. Let alpha be a function on AB that can be expressed as alpha x equals alpha 1x minus alpha 2x, where both alpha 1 and alpha 2 are increasing. Then for any f on AB, we define the integral of f d alpha to be the integral of a to b of f d alpha 1 minus the integral from a to b of f d alpha 2, provided that both of the integrals on the right exist. Now, by the very way that we have formulated our definitions, the integral of a to b of f d alpha is linear in both the f entry and the alpha entry. But the definitions are not satisfactory unless we can identify those alpha that can actually occur in the last definition. This leads us to a new class of functions. Definition: let f be a function on the interval a, b. For x and a, b, define capital V f x to be the sum from j equal 1 to k, absolute value of the quantity fpj minus fpj minus 1, where the supremum is taken over all partitions, capital script P equal P dot P1 through Pk, of the interval Ax. If capital Vf equals capital Vfb is finite, then the function f is said to be of bounded variation on the interval ab. In this circumstance, the quantity capital Vfb is called the total variation of f on ab. And if you stare at the definition of capital Vf, you can see what we're measuring is how much the function wiggles up and down, because we're summing up all possible fpj's minus fpj minus 1 at absolute value. A function that wiggles a lot will have very large total variation, and a function that wiggles only a little will have very small total variation, and a function that is constant will have zero total variation. A function of bounded variation has the property that its graph does not have unbounded total oscillation. Example, let f at x be sine x with domains at the interval 0, pi. Let us calculate vf. Let capital script P be a partition of 0 to pi. Since adding points to the partition only makes the sum larger, we may as well suppose that the partition contains the points pi over 2 and 3 pi over 2. Assuming that PL1 is pi over 2 and PL2 is 3 pi over 2, then we calculate the summation j equal 1 to k of absolute value, the quantity fpj minus fpj minus 1 equals summation j equals 1 to L1, of absolute value, the quantity fpj minus fpj minus 1, plus the sum from j equals L1 plus 1 to L2, absolute value, the quantity fpj minus fpj minus 1, plus the summation from j equals L2 plus 1 to k of absolute value, the quantity fpj minus fpj minus 1. However, f is increasing on the interval 0, pi over 2, which is the interval 0, L, 0 comma pl1. Therefore, the first sum is just summation j equals 1 to L1 of fpj minus fpj minus 1 without absolute value signs. And that's equal to fpl1 minus fp0, which is f of pi over 2 minus f of 0, which is 1. Similarly, f is monotone decreasing on the interval pi over 2, 3 pi over 2, which is the interval pl1, pl2. And it's monotone increasing on the interval 3 pi over 2, 2 pi. Thus, the second and third terms equal fpl1 minus fpl2, which is 2, and fpk minus fpl2, which is 1, respectively. It follows that the total variation of f, which is the variation of f at pi, 2 pi, is 1 plus 2 plus 1, which is 4. Of course, vfx for any x in 0, 2 pi could be computed by similar means. See the exercises. Example, in general, if f is a continuously differentiable function on an interval ab, then the total variation of f evaluated at x is the integral from a to x of the absolute value of f prime. This is easily proved using the mean value theorem. This assertion will be explored in the exercises. Example, the function f at x equals cosine x on the interval 0 to pi is a bounded variation. In fact, the total variation of f is 4 because the function goes from 1 down to 0 and then from 0 down to minus 1 and finally from minus 1 up to 0 and finally from 0 up to 1. Alternatively, one can obtain the same answer by calculating the integral vf as the integral from 0 to 2 pi of absolute value of f prime dx, which is the integral from 0 to 2 pi of the absolute value of sine x dx. And I would encourage you to try this for yourself and convince yourself that it works. Lemma. Let f be a function of bounded variation on the interval ab, then the function of vf is increasing on ab. That makes sense because as the argument of vf moves to the right, you're adding more terms to the sum that defines vf. So it apparently is increasing, and we'll write down a proof now. Let s less than t be elements of ab. Let capital script p equal p naught p1 through pk be a partition of as. Then capital script P tilde equals P naught P1 through PK comma T is a partition of the closed interval A comma T. And summation J equals 1 to K, absolute value of the quantity FPJ minus 1 is less than or equal to the summation J equal 1 to K, absolute value of the quantity FPJ minus 1 plus absolute value of the quantity FT minus FPK. And that, of course, is a candidate for VF at t, so this is less than or equal to capital VF at t. Taking the supremum on the left over all partitions, capital script P of the interval AS, we find that capital VF at S is less than or equal to capital VF at T. Lemma, let F be a function of bounded variation on the interval AB, then the function VF minus F is increasing on the interval AB. Proof, let S less than T be elements of AB. Pick epsilon bigger than zero. By the definition of VF, we may choose a partition, P, capital script P equal P naught P1 through PK, of the interval AS, so that capital VFS minus epsilon is less than summation j equal 1 to k, absolute value of the quantity FPJ minus 1. But then capital script P tilde equals P naught through PK comma T is a partition of the closed interval A comma T, and we have that summation j equal 1 to k, capital FPJ minus capital, lowercase FPJ minus lowercase FPJ minus 1, plus absolute value FT minus FS is less than or equal to the total variation of F at T. Using the inequality at the beginning of the proof, we may conclude that capital VFS minus epsilon plus FT minus FS is less than summation j equal 1 to k, absolute value FPJ minus 1, plus absolute value of the quantity FT minus FS, which, as we know, is less than or equal to capital V of FT. We conclude that capital VFS minus FS is less than capital VFT minus FT plus epsilon. Since the inequality holds for every epsilon bigger than 0, we see that VF minus F is increasing, and that's the result that we wanted. Now we may combine the last two lemmas to obtain our main result. If a function f is a bounded variation on AB, then f may be written as the difference of two increasing functions. Conversely, the difference of two increasing functions is a function of bounded variation. Proof is, if f is a bounded variation, write f equals vf minus the quantity vf minus f equals f1 minus f2. By the lemmas, both f1 and f2 are increasing. For the converse, assume that f equals f1 minus f2 with f1 and f2 increasing, then it's easy to see that the total variation of f at b is less than or equal to absolute value of the quantity f1b minus f1a plus absolute value of the quantity f2b minus f2a, and thus f is a bounded variation. Now the main point of this discussion is the following theorem. If f is a continuous function on AB, and if alpha is a bounded variation on AB, then the integral from A to B of f d alpha exists and is finite. If g is a bounded variation on AB, and if beta is a continuous function of bounded variation on AB, then the integral of g d beta exists and is finite. Proof, write the functions of bounded variation as the difference of increasing functions, then apply the relevant theorems. And that is the end of today's lecture. Thank you.